Good to see each and every one of you here this evening. Encourage you, if you will, take your Bibles and open them again to the book of Revelation as we continue our study from this morning. I generally walk up to a pulpit with about two sheets of paper, and I've got five different sheets of paper today. And I had the same amount of paper this morning, so it is what it is. We started this morning noticing the Alpha and the Omega, that term that is used concerning God the Father, Revelation chapter 1 in verse 8, after the prophecy is made concerning the return of Christ. We read there in Revelation chapter 1, verse 8, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, says the Lord, who is and who was and who is to come, the Almighty. Now, I'm going to get in trouble for this, but my wife said, you keep misreading the verse. She says, it says, I am Alpha and Omega. The thes aren't in there. I said, they are in the New King James. So, the definite article is in the Greek. Some translations choose to translate it, some don't. But I want to say a few things as we get started, because in chapter 1, verse 8, we do find God the Father, the Almighty, the Jehovah, saying, I am the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end, He who is, who was, and who is to come. We go to the end of the book of Revelation, chapter 22, as we mentioned this morning. And in chapter 22 and in verse 13, we have, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. And here it is Christ who is speaking. As we look at these passages, God begins His first segment of this revelation of Jesus Christ informing these Christians, I'm in control. Because that's what this statement is. In order for someone to say, I'm the beginning, and I'm the end, and especially as we go through this lesson and we see the beginning of what? The end of what? It is a statement of authority. Now, some of the best material that I can recommend on the book of Revelation, and if you want to understand the book of Revelation and be able to study someone's material that you can actually understand, and be able to understand very easily, I have two recommendations for you. Number one, Wesley Simons, who was here for gospel meeting last year from the Tri-City School of Preaching, the director of the school, has some very good information that I can get a hold of that's on audio, that is him teaching the book of Revelation, and it's very good material. If you want to go a little deeper than that, because he was doing it on a series on Sunday nights, doing one chapter each week, going through the book at Stony Creek when I was there, I recommend Jim McGuigan's material. He's a gospel preacher. He was born in Belfast, Ireland, and he's got a book on it. I believe the book is again in print. It was out of print for a while. But it's in print. It's just called Revelation, a commentary of Revelation, by Brother Jim McGuigan. If you have a Kindle or a computer and you would prefer to read it that way, I think it's $8 on Amazon, for the Kindle version. But it is excellent material. He also did a series of videos for International Bible School down in Texas, and those are available on DVD. And I personally like having the two of them combined, the book and him teaching it, because you just get some thoughts and some inflection of him teaching it, and you get to listen to somebody who's Irish teaching, and it's great. They were produced, I think, back in the late 70s, and so, you know, you might notice his suits are a little out of date, but the material's great. Said all that to say this, I sent him an email, because I've corresponded with him a number of times. I sent him an email when I got this topic, and I asked him concerning his thoughts on the Alpha and the Omega. And he said, well, I haven't done a great deal of in-depth study on that specifically. But he said, this is one thing that I would mention if I were presenting a lesson on it, and it's this. He says, you have to understand, in view of the book of Revelation, and it is, I believe, a clear understanding when you dig into the book and you keep it in its context, that the book of Revelation deals with the Christians and the persecution they were going to receive from Rome at the hands of Domitian, who was going to be one of the Caesars nearing the end of the first century. I don't believe it's Nero. I believe the book was written before the persecution actually began to occur. And I think chapter 17 of the book of Revelation is very clear on that. But when you look at Rome in the first century, what do you see? You see, first and foremost, a city that was head over a nation, and they called the city the Eternal City. It was, in their mind, the city that would never fall. It was the city that could not be destroyed. It was the city that was going to last forever. And on the throne, in Rome, was the Caesar. He was the king who was God. And when you look at the book of Revelation, and you look at the circumstances of the Christians in the first century when they were persecuted first by Nero and then later by Domitian, you see the problem between the Christians and the Romans was this. It was not that the Christians followed Christ. The Romans had absolutely no problem with the fact that Christians worshiped this individual who was called Jesus Christ. They didn't care about that. That was fine with them. The problem with the Christians was that they refused to worship Caesar. For in Rome, the rule was this. You worship any god you want to as long as you worship Caesar and you don't cause problems with other people's religion. It's a lot like America, where everything is fine. Tolerance is the law as long as there's no intolerance towards tolerance. But the Christians said no. The Christians would not bow to Caesar. It should bring your mind back to the book of Daniel. And Nebuchadnezzar, as he makes the statue and he tells his leaders and his governors to fall down at the sound of the music and bow before the statue that he has created because he is so great. And Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael refuse. The music is played and they remain standing. Everybody else bows. He says, I'll give you one last chance. Because if you do not bow, then you will be thrown into the fiery furnace. And he says, play the music again. And they will not bow. And their response to Nebuchadnezzar is basically paraphrasing, we don't know if our God will save us, but we know He's able. And if He wills, He will. And Nebuchadnezzar is so incensed by their response, he commands that the fiery furnace be heated up to 7 times its original heat, and then them to be cast into the furnace. It is so hot that even the individuals who are guarding them that throw them into the furnace are killed. But as he looks into the fiery furnace, what does he see? He sees not three. Not Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael alone thrown into the fiery furnace being burned up. No, he sees four. He sees the three of them walking around loose, having been freed from their bonds, and another who is like unto the Son of Man. His appearance, his visual appearance was as a man. I personally believe it was Christ pre-incarnate. But what was Christ's point to Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, and to Nebuchadnezzar? Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, you've been faithful. You're being rewarded. I'm on your side. You have nothing to fear. I'm behind you. To Nebuchadnezzar, you may think you're king. You may think you're God. You don't have any power. And you don't have to turn but a few chapters over when Nebuchadnezzar again gets the big head and God's going to teach him the lesson again. And we come forward to the first century and we find Christians and we find them being persecuted by a king who again believes he's God. Notice the persecution. I just want to go through some passages as we go through the book and look at these passages, and we're not going to spend a lot of time on any particular passage, but we're going to notice the persecution first, and then we're going to apply that idea of Christ as the beginning and the end, the authoritative one. Alright? Let's start with the persecution, chapter 2. These are the chapters that we're most generally familiar with, and one last thing that I want to mention on a note of studying the book of Revelation. I was having a discussion this morning, and I think it's worth saying. Almost every book in the Bible, when you begin reading every book in the Bible except Revelation, here's what you should do. You should begin by assuming that the things that are written are literal unless the context tells you this is figurative. Or this is a vision, and therefore, because it's a vision, it's not intended to be strictly literal or historical. Every book of the Bible should be read that way, except Revelation. Because you remember this morning when we began in chapter 1, verse 1, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants things which must shortly come to pass, and he sent and signified it by his angel. That term signified means it was given in the visions, it was given in signs and symbols that are to be interpreted, but not considered literal. With the exclusion of the sections in the context where the context dictates it's literal. So, when you interpret and you're studying every other book of the Old or New Testament, you begin by assuming everything stated is literal unless the context indicates it's figurative. In the book of Revelation, you should go into it accepting that everything is figurative unless the context tells you it's literal. Because Jesus said so. It's signs, it's symbols. As Wesley Simons would put it, it's a picture book. See the picture, understand the picture, and you'll understand the book. All right, chapter 2. We begin in verse 9. Jesus is here writing to the church at Smyrna, and he says, I know your works, your tribulation and poverty, but you are rich. And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. He says, I know, congregation at Smyrna, I know your tribulation. I know your persecution. I know what you're enduring. I know what the synagogue of Satan, and again, the synagogue of Satan, that's not a literal synagogue as some religions teach. It was a synagogue. It is the idea of a group of religious individuals, synagogue being that which was a gathering of Jewish believers in Judaism. And he says they are those who are persecuting the church. And by doing so, they're serving Satan. Who was Paul serving when he was putting to death the Christians in Acts chapter 8? Satan. All right? So we step forward to verse 10. He says, do not fear any of the things which you are about to suffer. He says, this persecution is coming. It's not here. You're about to suffer these things. He says, do not fear any of the things you are about to suffer. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Even in these times where he is being literal about the persecution that's coming, he uses figures like 10 days. He's not telling them that your sentence is going to be 10 days long and then you're going to be out of prison. The use of the number 10 in the book of Revelation is a complete time. You're going to end up in prison and you may die as a result. But you be faithful unto death because I know what you're suffering. We go on to chapter 6. In chapters 4 and 5, just to where you understand, the end of chapter 3, the end of the introduction to the churches, John sees a door open in heaven and he's bid to come through the door, he ends up in the throne room of God. So in chapters 4 and 5, he's in the throne room of God. There's no persecution happening. But chapter 6 comes along. Chapter 6, we see a scroll is opened by the Lamb, Christ. And he sees first a white horse in verse 2. And the white horse, based upon my judgment, is Christ. The rider upon the white horse is Christ. White in the book of Revelation is always the color of holiness. So to describe this as being someone persecuting the church would be incorrect. But then we begin in verse 3. Then he opened the second seal on the scroll. I heard the second living creature saying, "Come and see." Another horse, fiery red, went out, and it was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace from the earth, and that people should kill one another, and there was given him a great sword. So here comes another horse, but this time it's a red horse. And the individual sitting on the horse is given power to take peace from the earth. And he's given a sword. We go to verse 5. And he opened the third seal. And I heard a third living creature say, "Come and see." So I looked, and behold, a black horse. And he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarii, and 3 quarts of barley for a denarii, and do not harm the oil and the wine." Here comes another one. The first one took away the peace in the earth. The second one comes, and now there's a scarcity of food. This price for grain and for food is way too high for that day and time. He's saying there's going to be scarcity. Maybe it's famine. Maybe it's something else. You're going to suffer. We go again. In verse 7, when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of a living creature saying, "Come and see." So I looked, and behold, a pale horse. And the name on him who sat on it was Death. And Hades, that is hell, or that is the grave, followed with him. And power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with hunger, and with death, and by the beasts of the earth. Here we've got another horse coming, and again, more pain, more suffering, and death, and the grave. But then in chapter 6, verse 9, we see who's suffering. Chapter 6, verse 9, he opened the fifth seal, and I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. Who is it that's suffering? Who is it that's being persecuted with the sword? Who is it that is enduring scarcity? Who is it that death and Hades are chasing? It's the Christians. And they're there underneath the altar of God. John's still seeing this from the throne room of God. They're there under the altar and they're crying up, having been slain, to God and saying, verse 10, "How long, O Lord, are you going to allow this to continue? What are you going to do about it? Your children, your Christians, your church is being persecuted." They're given white robes. Notice the color again. They're given white robes. Robes of holiness. They're given white robes and they're told to rest a little while. But notice again. We skip forward to chapter 7. Chapter 7 and verse 14, and we read, "And I said to him, Sir, you know..." John has seen individuals who have on the white robes, and he says, "Who are they?" Or he is asked, "Who are they?" And he says, "You know who they are." He says, "Who are these arrayed in the white robes, and where did they come from?" He says, "Sir, you know." So he said to me, "These are the ones who came out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." We'll get back to that statement in a little bit. But Christians are dying because of the persecution. And John is seeing them. Go to chapter 8 and verse 1. When he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. Now, when Wesley was preaching this, he said, "Now you know there's no women in heaven." There was silence for a half hour. I don't think that's true. Verse 2, "And I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and to them there were given seven trumpets. that another angel, having a golden censer, came and stood at the altar, and he was given much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints ascended before God from the angel's hand. Then the angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and threw it to the earth, and there were noises, thunderings, lightnings, and an earthquake. So the seven angels who had seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. Here again, John sees the continuation, that seventh seal of the scroll that the Lamb had that he took from the Father. It's opened up, and here we see, first of all, silence. And then we see the incense. You want to know where the connection is to the Old Testament? The incense that was offered. But here, the incense isn't just the sweet aroma, it's the prayers of the saints. Why would the saints be praying? What had they been praying for? Relief from the persecution. And here's how you know that's what it is. Having offered the incense, what does the angel do? He goes and fills the censer, not with more prayers, but with fire. And God's judgment begins on those who have persecuted the church. Chapter 10. Chapter 10, John sees a mighty angel. He has one foot on the land and one foot in the sea. And he has a little scroll, a little book. And John is told to take the book from the mighty angel and to eat it. If you're familiar with the book of Ezekiel, you know that Ezekiel was told to take the book from God and to eat it. And he was told it's going to be sweet in your mouth, but it's going to be bitter in your belly. John's told to take the book, and the angel gives it to him, and he says it's going to be sweet in your mouth, and it's going to be bitter in your belly. The idea there is that the Christians were going to have hope in the future. It was coming. The proclamation would be good, but before that comes, there's going to be hard times. There's going to be more persecution. And we step forward again to chapter 11. Chapter 11, we see two witnesses. Now, it's interesting. Because you know the term witness? Go in your mind, go back to chapter 1, and you remember that Jesus was described as the faithful witness? Now, we don't think much about the term witness, but if you knew what the Greek term, you might think about it a little differently. For the Greek term is the term from which we get our word in the English, martyr. A witness in the book of Revelation is one who just well might die for that witness, for that testimony. And here we see two witnesses. Two witnesses that are there in the midst of a city, and they're proclaiming God's message. And when you look at the context, when you look at who these witnesses are based upon the miracles they do, it seems pretty clear it's Elijah and Moses. And they're killed. The people of the city killed them. And they lay them in the midst of the street and they throw a party. And they leave them in the streets for 3 days. Third day, they're resurrected. Persecution. Chapter 12. Chapter 12, verse 17. In chapter 12, you have a woman who's about to give birth, and you have a dragon. The dragon is Satan. Text says that clearly. And Satan is waiting, anticipating for the child to be born to devour the child. But before he can do that, the angel or the woman is given wings, and she flies away out of the dragon's reach. And then we see, beginning later on in the same chapter, there's a war in heaven between Satan and his angels and Michael and the angels of God. And Satan is cast down. Verse 17, and the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Who's that? Who is it that keeps the commandments of God? Who is it that has the testimony of Jesus Christ? It's the church. So the dragon says, okay, I can have what I want. I'm going to hammer the church. I'm going to turn up the persecution on the church. I'm going to do damage to God. Chapter 13. We are introduced to the beasts that come up. First, the sea beast in the first part of the chapter. In chapter 13, verse 6, the sea beast opens his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. It was granted to him to make war with the saints to overcome them, and authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. Rome is ramping up the persecution. Chapter 13, verse 10. He leads into captivity and shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. Patience for what? Endurance for what? Persecution. We go further in the chapter, verse 15. And now we've got not the sea beast, but the land beast. Another beast arises up. Verse 15, he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not to worship the image of the beast to be killed. So here, you don't worship the image. You don't worship the image of the beast, you die. You go look in the first century. You didn't worship Caesar. You didn't worship the image of Caesar. Why is it that all the coins in the first century had Caesar's image on it? Why is it you go back to the Old Testament and God told them in the Ten Commandments, you don't craft anything with the image of what you think I appear to be? For that was idolatry. It says, you don't craft images of me. The opposite? Caesar said, I'm God. You craft images of me. He says, you, the one who wouldn't bow down to the image of the beast, he gets killed. Chapter 16. Chapter 16, we're introduced to the harlot. I'm sorry, that's not chapter 16 yet. Chapter 16, beginning in verse 17, the wrath of God begins to be poured out on Babylon. You see Babylon in the book of Revelation. It harkens back to the Old Testament prophets. It's the great city that persecuted God's people, that God brought judgment on, is Rome in Revelation. Chapter 16, beginning in verse 17, then the seventh angel poured out the bowl into the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple of heaven from the throne, saying, it is done. And there were noises and thunderings and lightnings and a great earthquake, such a mighty and great earthquake as had not occurred since men were on the earth. Now the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and great Babylon was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. Here's this city that has been persecuting the church constantly, day in and day out, and finally the wrath of God is going to be brought upon them, for they have been remembered by God. Then every island, verse 20, fled away, and the mountains were not found, and the great hail from heaven fell upon men, each hailstone about the weight of a talent. Men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, since the plague was exceedingly great. Then, chapter 17, verse 1, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came to me and talked with me, saying, come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. And John will see, verse 6, he will see the harlot, and he will see on her forehead, verse 5, mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Verse 6, and I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. Babylon, the great city, is now pictured as the harlot, the one who's become drunk on the blood of the saints of God. And the vision of her is so astounding and so awe-inspiring that even John is amazed. Verse 7, the angel says, "Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has 7 heads and 10 horns. And he goes on to describe the beast and gives the explanation. But notice verse 14. These will make war. The beast and the head will make war with the lamb, and the lamb will overcome them, for he is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful." Step over to chapter 19. Chapter 19, there is a war that happens. Chapter 19, verses 19 and 20, "And I saw the beast, the kings of the earth, and their armies gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army." The one sitting on the horse is Christ. Verse 20, "The beast was captured, and with him the false prophets who worked signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and who worshipped his image. Those two were cast alive into the lake of fire burning with brimstone, and the rest were killed with the sword which proceeded from the mouth of him who sat on the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh." Ultimate judgment comes upon Rome. Satan does war with the Lamb, the one sitting on the white horse, and he loses. Now, that's the persecution. A few moments we have remaining. The Alpha and the Omega. When you see the book of Revelation, it's written to first century Christians to tell them, you're about to go through the ringer. You're about to be persecuted and maybe even unto death. And you're going to cry out to God and you're going to wonder how long it's going to continue. And here's what you need to know. I am the Alpha and the Omega. The beginning and the end. The first and the last. He who was and who is to come. I'm on the throne. Caesar's not on the throne. Rome's not the eternal city. There's a new Jerusalem coming out of the throne of God. The church has been delivered. It's prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. You have nothing to worry about. I'm on the throne. And notice how it's demonstrated. We're just going to go through some of these. There's way too many to notice. But when you begin to look at it from this perspective, you can almost go through the whole book of Revelation. Just look at every reference to Christ, and it's just another piece in the image saying, I'm in control. Chapter 2 and in verse 5, God, Christ, the one who is giving this revelation, has authority over judgment. Chapter 2, verse 5, remember, he says to the church at Ephesus, remember therefore from where you have fallen. Repent and do the first works, or else I will come to you quickly and remove your lampstand from its place unless you repent. Christ has authority over the church. First and last, he has authority. Chapter 2, verse 12, or verse 10, he not only has authority over the church to bring judgment, punishment, but he also has authority to bring judgment over the church in reward. Chapter 2, verse 10, those who are faithful, I will give unto them a crown of life. Chapter 22, and in verse 12, here, before he says, I'm the Alpha and Omega, he says in verse 12, behold, I am coming quickly, and my reward is with me. The Alpha and the Omega, what does he have? He has power over judgment, both to do good and to do evil to those based upon their works. The Alpha and the Omega, he has authority over revelation. Chapter 1 and verse 11, I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last. What you see, write. He has the authority to tell John, you write in this book and you send it to the churches. He has authority over revelation. Chapter 1 and in verse 19, he says, the mystery of the 7 stars, write these things, verse 19, which you have seen, and the things which are and the things that will take place after this. He not only has authority over revelation, but he has authority to give revelation that involves that which has happened, that which is happening, that which will happen. You go back to the book of Isaiah that we noticed this morning, chapter 41, verse 4, chapter 44, verse 6. And what do you see? You see God saying, let me give the idols a challenge. Let me ask you, if you're going to be idolaters, let me ask your idols for a little challenge here. Tell them to tell you what has happened in the past before you existed, what is happening now, and what's going to happen in the future. Can't do it. They can't tell you anything. They're idols. Who's Jehovah? He's the one who was, who is, and who is to come. The first and the last. He declares the end from the beginning. He's God. The Lamb has power not only over revelation, but over death. Chapter 1 and verse 5, we've already read this morning that He was the faithful witness. Again, the term's martyr. The faithful witness, the firstborn from the dead. He was the one who died so that we might live. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 9, in case the dead for every man. He is the one with authority over death. Chapter 2 and in verse, chapter 5 and in verse 6. Notice what we read. The first time we're introduced to Jesus as the Lamb in the book. Chapter 5, verse 6. And I looked and behold, in the midst of the throne and of the four living creatures and in the midst of the elders stood a Lamb as though it had been slain, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. Then He came and took the scroll out of the right hand of Him who sat on the throne. God the Almighty, God the Father sitting on the throne, and John sees this Lamb standing up that's been slain. It's the Lamb that's been slain who's not dead. It's Christ. And Christ is the one who can open the scroll. Chapter 5 and in verse 9, and they sang a new song, the elders and the creatures, they sing a new song saying, "You are worthy to take the scroll." They're praising, they're adifying, they're singing praise of adoration to the Lamb. He says, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for You were slain and have redeemed us to God by Your blood out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and have made us kings and priests to God, and we shall reign in the earth." Who is the Lamb? He's the one who has authority over death because He was slain and He is alive again. He is worthy. He's holy. The Alpha and the Omega is not only one who has authority over death, but He has authority over the vengeance of God. And this is beyond just judgment. It's not only judgment eternally, but it's vengeance here and now. Chapter 2 and in verse 12, He says to the angel at the church of Pergamos, He says, "These things says He who has the sharp two-edged sword." If you're the church this gets written to, and the first introductory statement from Christ is, "I've got a sharp two-edged sword, you better watch out." But notice also, He says in chapter 6, or we read in chapter 6, He opens the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake, verse 12, stars from heaven begin to fall to the earth. This is all imagery that comes from the Old Testament prophets. It's not unfamiliar to the Christians. The sky recedes as a scroll and is rolled up, and the kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave and every free man hide themselves in the caves and in the rocks of the mountains, and they say to the mountains and the rocks, "Fall on us." Why? Why in the world would you go hide in a cave and then want the mountain to come down on top of you? "Fall on us and hide us from the face of Him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of His wrath has come, and who is able to stand?" Lambs are not violent creatures. They're not lions. But here, Jesus isn't described as the lion. He's the Lamb. But they desire the mountains to fall on them because of His wrath. He's the Alpha and the Omega of vengeance. He's the Alpha and Omega of provision. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4 says, the rock that followed Israel in the wilderness was Christ. What rock? You remember the rock that first Moses struck and water came out? And secondly, Moses struck when he should have spoken to it and water came out? What was that? That was provision. That was God providing for Israel. But if you look in the book of Revelation and you notice chapter 7 and verse 17, notice what we read. For the Lamb who is in the midst of the throne will shepherd them and will lead them to living fountains of water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. The question that's asked in the end of chapter 6 is, who can stand in the day of the wrath of the Lamb? Who is it that can stand when God, when Christ brings His judgment? Chapter 7 is the answer. Before the wrath is brought, that's chapter 8. Before the wrath is brought, there's angels that come out from heaven, and what do? They go and they find every Christian and they put a mark on the foreheads of the Christians to identify them as God's servants. And you always hear about the mark of the beast in the book of Revelation. You never hear about the mark of God. Guess what? Neither one's literal. The point to those Christians in the first century is, I know who belongs to me. And you're not going to suffer when I bring my vengeance. Who can stand in the day of the wrath of the Lamb? Christians can. Because the Lamb will shepherd them to the fountains of water of life, and God will wipe away every tear. But notice also, chapter 21. Chapter 21, and in verse 6, we read this morning. He said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, and I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. Chapter 22, and in verse 1, and he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb. Who has the water of life? Who has all the provision you will ever need as a Christian? Christ. But you remember that Israel in the wilderness didn't just receive water. Chapter 2 and in verse 17, Jesus says this. Chapter 2, verse 17, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna to eat. And I will give him a white stone, and on the stone a new name written, which no one knows except him who receives it. See, the Lamb, Jesus, the Alpha and the Omega, has not only authority over the water of life, but of the manna from heaven. He says, I will give my provision to you. But consider in the same verse that the Alpha and the Omega has not only authority over judgment, revelation, death, vengeance, provision, but also identity. How many times as you go through the Old Testament and New Testament does God give someone a new name? He does it to Abraham. He does it to Jacob. He does it so often. Jesus does it to Peter. And you remember what we just read? I will give some the hidden manna to eat, and I will give him a white stone, and on the stone a new name written, which no one knows except him who receives it. He's the Alpha and the Omega over identity. We're out of time, so let me give you the rest of the list. And if you want a copy of it, you can go spend some time looking at it. Jesus Christ is the Alpha and Omega over God's long-suffering. Chapter 2, verse 21, verse 22, verse 23 talks about the patience of God. Jesus is saying, I'm willing to be long-suffering, but I also control when that long-suffering ends. He's the first and the last, the authority over the patience of God. He is the ruler over the nations of the earth, chapter 1, verse 5, chapter 2, verse 26. He is the one in the book of Revelation who has control over the book of life. If you read about the book of life, you know, where the names of the faithful are written. But in the book of Revelation, it's the Lamb's book of life. Jesus Christ has record of your name. He has control over your name, over your presence, and He can block you out of His book. He has authority even over authority. This one I have to mention. Chapter 3 and verse 7. We read, the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, "These things says He who is holy, He who is true, who has the key of David, who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens." The door that God opens, you're not going to shut. The door He shuts, you're not going to open. It's a statement that's made in Isaiah chapter 22 and verse 22, where one of Hezekiah's servants is replaced by God. He says, "You're out, and you're in. And the door that God opens, no one's going to shut. The door He shuts, no one's going to open." He has authority over authority. He is the Alpha and Omega when it comes to entrance to the New Jerusalem and His new name, chapter 3 and verse 12. He's the Alpha and the Omega over creation. Chapter 4 and in verse 11, He is the one who created. Colossians chapter 1, verse 15, He is the one for whom creation was made. Colossians 1, verses 16 and 17, and by whom it exists. He's the Alpha and the Omega over prophecy and time. Chapter 5, verses 1 through 7. He's the Alpha and the Omega when it comes to holiness and worthiness. He's the beginning and the end. He's the example of holiness. He's the Alpha and the Omega over redemption. He's the Alpha and the Omega over all nations of the earth. He can bring them into existence and He can destroy them. He's the Alpha and the Omega over salvation. He is the Shepherd. He is the one of whom it has been, or the kingdom has been created. He is the one who has power over Satan to cast him out. He is the Alpha and the Omega, chapter 14 and verse 10, over hell. And He is ultimately the one who brings victory. The book of Revelation is a single message to the Christians. You win. Have you ever been in a game, a contest, where you started and you didn't know who was going to win? Most of them are that way. The book of Revelation has one point. To the Christians who are about to enter the contest of their life for their life, God says, you win if you're faithful. You'll be rewarded. You'll be part of the church that is the bride of Christ, chapter 19, verses 7 through 9. You'll be part of the new Jerusalem adorned as a wife, as a bride for the Lamb, chapter 21, verse 9, chapter 21, verse 2. You'll enter into the temple of God, chapter 21, verse 22. You'll enter into the light of the throne of God and of the Lamb, chapter 21, verse 23. You'll partake of the water of life, chapter 22, verse 1. You'll have access to the tree of life, chapter 22 and verse 2. You will be in the presence of the throne of God, chapter 22 and verse 3. And He concludes with this: I come quickly. It's not Jesus is coming soon. It's I come quickly. It's the manner. He comes when He's ready. He brings judgment in His time. And when He comes, no one will stop. Are you ready? Are you faithful? Because the only way any of the promises, any of the assurances, and any of the hope found in the book of Revelation applies to you is if you're faithful until death. If you're here this evening and you have need to respond to the invitation, it's made available as we stand and as we sing.